In chapter 7, Paul moves to another matter that he was requested to respond to from the fractured community in Corinth. Now he says, concerning the matters about which you wrote, and he quotes, it is a good thing for a man not to touch a woman. So let's try to see what's happening in Corinth behind that question or that statement. Were some of the Corinthian community genuinely striving to imitate Paul by living celibate lives, only to be told that they were failing to fulfill their obligations? Were some of the women wanting to avoid sexual relations in their search for holiness? Were some seeking asceticism as a higher way and using it, as they were using other claims, to assert their superiority over others in the community? Were they looking upon celibacy as the easiest way to avoid sins of sexual immorality that had plagued them in the past and that continued to trouble them? Any or all of these currents of opinion may well have provided the background to the question, it is a good thing for a man not to touch a woman? Paul's reply, as we shall see, is nicely nuanced. Paul turns his attention first to those who are already married. His aim here is not to speak of the beauty of marriage or to depth the special graces that are given to a married couple so that their married love will be a means of mutual sanctification. Hints of his understanding and appreciation of marriage can be found in the text, but his aim is to respond carefully to the precise question that's troubling the Corinthians. One thing is clear. Paul wants to rid them of the idea that sexual abstaining is a cure-all for sexual immorality. On the contrary, the sexual drive is so strong that those who are married will find that their safest place to live chaste lives is in living their marriage well. Paul wants them to exercise great care about committing themselves to sexual abstention and to make sure that any decision in this direction is mutual. In response to that, Paul writes, yes, it is a good thing for a man not to touch a woman. But, he goes on, because of cases of sexual immorality, each man should have his own wife and each woman her own husband. The husband should give to his wife her conjugal rights, and likewise the wife to her husband. For the wife doesn't have authority over her own body, but the husband does. Likewise, the husband doesn't have authority over his own body, but the wife does. Don't deprive one another, except perhaps by mutual agreement, for a set time, to devote yourselves to prayer, and then come together again so that Satan may not tempt you because of your lack of self-control. This I say by way of concession, not of command. A brief comment on that. Paul's sensitivity to the mutuality of husband and wife is quite outstanding. Rarely do his contemporaries consider such matters from the woman's perspective, as Paul does here. And he goes on, I wish that all were as I myself am, namely celibate, but each has a particular gift from God, one having one kind and another a different kind. To the unmarried and the widows, I say it would be well for them to remain unmarried as I am. But if they're not practicing self-control, they should marry. It's better to marry than to be aflame with passion. So Paul's words here on celibacy cause him to turn his attention for a moment to those who are in a position to follow his example, those who have never married, as well as widowers and widows. He suggests that they think seriously about celibacy, but only if they have the gift. It's no good attempting celibacy unless they can live a sexually moral life and can mature in love as a celibate. If they don't have the gift, let them marry. It gives them a way of expressing their sexual needs. It's a much safer way to live chastely. And Paul goes on to remind Christian couples now of Jesus' teaching. And he writes, To the married, I have this command, not I, but the Lord, that the wife should not separate from her husband, but if she does separate, let her remain unmarried, or else be reconciled to her husband. And that the husband should not divorce his wife. I'll quote from Luke chapter 16, where Jesus says, anyone who divorces his wife and marries another commits adultery. And whoever marries a woman divorced from her husband commits adultery. Mark chapter 10 has Jesus say, they're no longer two, they're one flesh. Therefore, what God has joined together, let no one separate. Whoever divorces his wife and marries another commits adultery against her. And if she divorces her husband and marries another, she commits adultery. In Matthew, there's a slight addition. It's in chapter 19, verse 9. And I'll read to you from the New Jerusalem Bible, where Jesus says, anyone who divorces his wife, I'm not speaking of illicit marriage, and marries another, is guilty of adultery. So Paul reinforces that here, reminding the Corinthian of Jesus' teaching. Now he turns his attention to marriages in which one or other of the partners is not a Christian. In Corinthian law, either party could divorce, simply making a declaration before witnesses and registering the fact. If the Christian spouse were divorced by his or her non-Christian spouse, what was to be done? Was remarriage possible for the Christian? Alternatively, how does a person committed to the gospel live in a marriage relationship with a spouse who's not committed to it? Is the Christian obliged to divorce? Is he or she permitted to divorce? So that's the question Paul is facing in his response, verse 12. To the rest I say, I and not the Lord. So he's not quoting Jesus' teaching, he's giving his own best wisdom on the matter. If any believer has a wife who is an unbeliever and she consents to live with him, he shouldn't divorce her. And if any woman has a husband who's an unbeliever and he consents to live with her, she shouldn't divorce him. For the unbelieving husband is made holy through his wife, and the unbelieving wife is made holy through her husband. Otherwise, your children would be unclean, whereas in fact, they're holy. But if the unbelieving partner separates, let it be so. In such a case, the brother or sister is not bound. It's to peace that God has called you. Wife, for all you know, you might save your husband. Husband, for all you know, you might save your wife. So Paul, in attempting to respond to the problem, the question in Corinth, he's not claiming to be covering every eventuality or to have the last word on such a complex matter. What was to happen, for example, when a believing spouse gave up the faith, in fact, if not in theory, and made it impossible for the believing spouse to live his or her faith, or to experience peace in the marriage? Into what category would such a marriage fall? There's no substitute for doing what Paul himself does in this passage. We must examine the actual relationship in the light of the nature of Christian marriage as a sacrament of God's unfailing love. And we must attempt a wise, compassionate, and realistic discernment, remembering, as Paul says, and this is surely the key, it is to peace that God has called you. Fidelity to love can mean the cross. This has been a central theme of the letter. But not every cross is redemptive, nor can remaining in an unloving relationship, which is destructive, be described as being faithful to love. People with the best will in the world make commitments which prove to be impossible to keep for any number of reasons. Where the commitment, however, is genuine, and where faith values are shared and peace enjoyed, an arbitrary decision to renounce the commitment is a breaking of faith. Being a disciple of Jesus doesn't protect a person against the ordinary situations of hurt or misunderstanding or being victim of another person's infidelity that are part of the human condition. The fact that two disciples of Jesus pledge their love to each other in faith doesn't guarantee them against marriage breakdown. Because love doesn't control, and one partner cannot prevent the sin or the infidelity or the breaking of the covenant by the other. In Jesus' world, as in our own, it was all too easy to break the marriage covenant and to seek in another relationship the happiness one failed to find in marriage. If a marriage is destructive, this may be the appropriate response. Jesus' words, however, stand as a warning against a too easy neglect of one's obligations. Some suffering is destructive. To undergo it has no merit and no reward. Some suffering, however, is redemptive. The latter is revealed by its fruit, a deepening of love. In verse 17, Paul continues, "However that may be, let each of you lead the life that the Lord has assigned, to which God called you. This is my rule in all churches. Was anyone at the time of his call already circumcised? Well, let him not seek to remove the marks of circumcision. Was anyone at the time of his call uncircumcised? Well, let him not seek circumcision. Circumcision is nothing, and uncircumcision is nothing. Obeying the command of God is everything. Let each of you remain in the condition in which you were called." So the key principle in this whole matter is that the only thing that matters ultimately is God's will. If God calls us to married love, being married is the best way that we can experience communion with God and grow in intimacy with Jesus. If God calls us to celibate love, then that is the way we can best live our Christian life. Each person must be attentive to and obey God's call. Similarly, in verse 21, Paul says, "Were you a slave when you were called? Well, don't be concerned about it. If you can gain your freedom, avail yourself of the opportunity. For whoever was called in the Lord as a slave is a freed person, belonging to the Lord, just as whoever was free when called is a slave of Christ. You were bought with a price. Don't become slaves of human masters. If, whatever condition you are called, brothers and sisters, there remain with God." Just a comment. All along, Paul has been addressing the question of marriage or celibacy. He's not arguing for the keeping of the status quo. He's encouraging us to, as he says, remain with God. If we truly want what God wants, and if we listen for God's call, we'll find the right way in which to live out our Christian lives in and for the world. No structure will remain unchallenged by love. And now in verse 25, Paul turns his attention to another group in the community, namely the virgins. And he says, "Concerning virgins, I have no command of the Lord, but I give my opinion as one who by the Lord's mercy is trustworthy. I think that in view of the impending crisis, it's well for you to remain as you are. Are you bound to a wife? Well, don't seek to be free. Are you free from a wife? Don't seek a wife. But if you marry, you don't sin. If a virgin marries, she doesn't sin. Yet, those who marry will experience distress in this life, and I would spare you that. I mean, brothers and sisters, the appointed time has grown short. Brackets. So Paul is still of the opinion, as he was when he wrote to the Thessalonians from Corinth, he's still of the opinion that it's only going to be short time now. There's an imminent coming of the Lord. Certain things are in a very hot perspective, and we've got to look at it in the light of that imminent day of the Lord and judgment. So he says, I mean, brothers and sisters, the appointed time has grown short. From now on, let even those who have wives be as though they had none, and those who mourn as though they were not mourning, and those who rejoice as though they were not rejoicing, and those who buy as though they had no possessions, and those who deal with the world as though they have no dealings with it. And his reason for all of this, for the present form of this world is passing away. I want you, he says, to be free from anxieties. The unmarried man is anxious about the affairs of the Lord, how to please the Lord. The married man is anxious about the affairs of the world, how to please his wife. And his interests are divided, says Paul. And the unmarried woman and the virgin are anxious about the affairs of the Lord, so that they may be holy in body and spirit. But the married woman is anxious about the affairs of the world, how to please her husband. Look, I'm saying this for your own benefit, not to put any restraint upon you, but to promote good order and unhindered devotion to the Lord. Our mind might go to a story in Luke chapter 10 of the two sisters, Mary and Martha, and Jesus is visiting them. And in these two, we see two ways of attending to the Lord. Mary, by sitting quietly listening to Jesus. Martha, by preparing some food to be hospitable to him. Now, Martha's problem was not that her way of serving Jesus was in itself inferior to that of Mary. Her problem was that in her attending to Jesus, as he says, she was distracted, anxious, troubled, whereas Mary was not. That's the difference between them. Every moment of our life can be a prayer. No activity, no involvement need distract us from God, who's at the heart of everything and who loves us and calls us to himself. Every occupation, and in a most wonderful way, marriage and family life can be sacraments of love. So, as like Martha, we're busy carrying out the mission he has given us in and for the world, let us remember, like Mary, to sit at the Lord's feet and listen to him. In this way, we may gradually learn in our silence and in our activity to give him our unhindered devotion. In verse 36, Paul continues, if anyone thinks that he's not behaving properly towards the person to whom he's engaged, if his passions are strong, and so it has to be, let him marry as he wishes. It's no sin. Let them marry. But if someone stands firm in his resolve, being under no pressure but having his own desire under control, and he's determined in his own mind to keep her as his fiancée, he will do well. The one who marries his fiancée does well. The one who refrains from marriage will do better. A wife is bound as long as her husband lives. But if the husband dies, she's free to marry anyone she wishes, only in the Lord. But in my judgment, she's more blessed if she remains as she is. And I think that I too have the Spirit of God. So that's Paul's best attempt to clarify problems of sexual relationships in the community at Corinth. In chapter 8, he turns to another problem that they've asked him about that's concerning the community. As he says, now, concerning food offered to idols. While at first sight, the issue which takes up this in the following two chapters appears not to relate to our experience. A Christian community living in a largely non-Christian society does face similar problems. And Paul's magnificent reply has much to teach us about how to love others in a culturally mixed community in which there can be wide differences in the way people see things. To grasp the issue at stake at Corinth, we need to remember that sanctuaries devoted to various deities were an important part of the civic landscape. From writings of the time, including the travel guide of Pausanias, and from archaeological discoveries, we know of the existence in Corinth of temples to Zeus, to Hera, to Poseidon, to Asclepius, Aphrodite, Apollo, Demeter, and Persephone. Also, among others, temples to Octavia, the sister of Augustus, to the Egyptian gods Isis and Serapis. Civic occasions abounded, which centred on one or other of these sanctuaries. Various guilds and various tribal groups in this multicultural city, as well as sporting and other confraternities, gathered regularly at the sanctuary of their protective god or goddess to seek favours and to express thanks. Then there were all the major family festivities, such as marriages, funerals, births, that included offerings made at a shrine. Friends were invited. Some of the offering were later consumed by the priests. Some was consumed by the guest in a room adjacent to the shrine. And the rest was sold by merchants in a public market and found its way to the tables of private homes. So one reason for the question may be what Paul wrote in an earlier letter. A letter we don't have. It was referred to in chapter 5, verse 9. Surely, some of them were saying, when you told us to avoid idolaters, you were expecting us to go out of the world. As can be seen from the above survey, to avoid eating all meat offered to idols, they'd be unable to participate in any public festivities and would have to refuse all invitations to other people's homes. So Paul's response indicates that most of the community had no problem eating such food. the idols were not real anyhow. However, some were troubled. Others were in danger of reverting to idolatry. So one can imagine how difficult the whole area was to Jewish Christians. Joining the Christian community brought them to quite a different relationship to society than that to which they were accustomed. And because of their strict Jewish teaching on matters such as the present one, they could well have been especially vulnerable to scandal. And you remember the decision made at the Assembly of Jerusalem. This was one thing that that assembly asked the Gentiles of Antioch to observe, not to eat meat offered to idols or meat with blood in it that had been strangled, because the Jews in the community had been brought up forever not to do that. And they would find it offensive and difficult to be in community sharing food with Gentiles if they were eating such things. So out of sensitivity, the community in Jerusalem asked them not to put that pressure on their Jewish brothers and sisters. Here in Corinth, it's reversed. Most of the people in Corinth that became Christian were Gentiles. Some of them were Jews. And he's asking, well, we'll see, he's asking them to be sensitive to each other in this matter. So this is what he writes. Now concerning food offered to idols. And he quotes what was in the letter. We know that all of us possess knowledge. In other words, they know what they're doing. Trust them. Paul responds, knowledge puffs up. It's love that builds up. Anyone, Paul continues, anyone who claims to know something doesn't yet have the necessary knowledge. But anyone who loves God is known by God. So it seems that the Corinthians are defending their practice of eating food that had been offered to idols by claiming that all those who are doing so possess the gift of knowledge. They're not going to the temple and offering the meat. They're just enjoying the meat that's sold in the marketplace. The gift of the Spirit they have enables them to know how to behave. Paul's response goes straight to the heart of the matter. Knowledge is, of course, important. But they must be careful because knowledge can be a basis for self-exaltation and pride. Knowledge, therefore, that is not suffused with love may be accurate within its bounds of limits, but it's not true, for it neglects the only ultimate truth, namely that God is love. And so it neglects everything is known. Without that perspective on love, it's misconstrued. So Paul goes on. As to the eating of food offered to idols, you say we know that no idol in the world really exists, and you know there's no God but one. Indeed, says Paul, even though there may be no so-called gods in heaven or on earth, as in fact there are many gods and many lords, yet for us there's only one God, the Father, from whom are all things, for whom we exist. And there's only one Lord, Jesus, the Messiah, through whom are all things, and through whom we exist. Paul's all the time, yes, they need to make discernments, we all do, but he's bringing them back all the time to their image of God and what God is revealed as through Jesus. To keep their eye on Jesus, then their discernments will be valid and helpful and loving and sensitive. It's Jesus who reveals the mystery, drawing us to ever deeper understanding of the wisdom of God. Paul takes us to the heart of the real, and in the mystery of his own heart, he shows us the mind and will, the design and intention of God, and the activity of God's Spirit. In coming to know Jesus, we come to know ourselves and the whole of creation. For, as Paul has just said, through him are all things, and through him we exist. In his person, Jesus expresses how it is that God approaches us and how it is that we respond to God. Jesus is the mediator, the peacemaker, the bridge builder. Paul wants the community at Corinth to fix their eyes on Jesus, for it's Jesus who will show them how to behave sensitively towards each other. If they think of themselves as strong because they're not scrupulous over eating meat offered to so-called idols, they must see that the only strength worthy of the name is strength in love. For the one God, the Father, is love. And the one Lord, Jesus, who's called them into communion with him, is calling them to love. So Paul, to this point, has gently questioned the accuracy of their claimed knowledge. And he's lifted the whole discussion of whether they can eat meat that was sold in the marketplace and served up in the home that had been offered way back to idols. He's lifted that whole discussion into the context of a God who is a loving Father, and of Jesus, who is their way to God. And having done that, he's ready now to respond to their question. We'll begin his response in the following presentation.